Headlines: the Taliban capture the city of Faizabad in northern Afghanistan, bringing to 9 the number of provincial capitals seized by the militant group in less than a week. North Korea warns that its neighboring South will face a serious security crisis if it conducts joint military drills with the United States. And Australia extends a lockdown in Melbourne for another 7 days as the country struggles to stop the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Taliban have seized a 9th provincial capital in Afghanistan in less than a week, as the group is pushing ahead with a rapid offensive to overrun the country. Local officials say the militants are now in control of Faizabad. In the northeast, following days of heavy fighting, the group seems to have tightened further their grip on northern Afghanistan with the capture of the capital, Badakhshan province. The gain came hours after the militants hit the capital cities of Baghlan province and the western border province of Farah. The Taliban have seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and is now battling for several key cities. They have intensified their offensive following the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. Correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, says Faizabad fell into the hands of the Taliban after a large-scale attack on the city.
Over 900 Taliban militants, including some foreign nationals, had conducted a large-scale attack from four directions on the city of Faizabad. As a result, and as these military commanders there say, Afghan military forces have retreated and they are fighting still against the Taliban militants who are following Afghan security forces very close to Faizabad airport. In the meantime, the rest of areas in northern Afghanistan and northeast of Afghanistan, also the scene of collapse of big cities into the hands of Taliban. For instance, Shebirghan, the capital city of Juzjan province, is under the control of Taliban. After that, the Taliban captured Talikhan, the capital of northeastern Tahar province, and then Aibak city, the capital of Samangan province, came under the control of Taliban militants. And currently, fierce fightings are underway between both sides. I mean, Afghan security forces backed by local armed fronts and Taliban militants in the suburbs and inside some parts of the city of Pule Khumri, the capital city of Baghlan province. That is another northern province that connects northern Afghanistan to the Afghan capital, Kabul, via Parwan province.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says foreign intervention in the region is a source of tensions and poses threats. In a meeting with Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hossein, Raisi said regional cooperation is a prerequisite for lasting security and peace. The Iranian president also thanked Hossein for Baghdad's invitation of Iran to a regional summit planned for later this month. The Iraqi foreign minister, for his part, said lasting security can only be established in the region with help of both Tehran and Baghdad. Iran has once again rejected the U.S. and U.K. allegations that the Islamic Republic was behind a recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. This after Washington and its allies, including Israel, renewed their accusation against Tehran during a U.N. Security Council meeting on Monday. We have more on this report.
Iran has once again denied having any link to the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative in the UN, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated, saying there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the claim. Ershadi also urged the Council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which as usual are blindly supported by certain Western countries. The Iranian diplomat responded to renewed accusations by the U.S. and its allies during Security Council meeting. During the virtual session, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even vowed to punish Iran for the alleged attack. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusations, warning that it will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any threat against its national security. Chief Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, also warned Israel not to shorten its life by making a wrong and aggressive move. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that Iran is carefully monitoring the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K. and Israel in the region.
Such moves are made to create chaos and confusion among countries in the Persian Gulf area. Tehran is ready to neutralize any plot to destabilize the region.
Following the ship incident, resistance sources told a media outlet that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrikes on a Syrian airport. But Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel in its blame game against Iran while turning a blind eye to Israel's own hostile acts in the region. According to a report by Wall Street Journal, over a dozen of Iranian vessels had fallen victim to the Israeli attacks, some of which openly claimed by the regime. It seems that the West is trying to shift the international attention from Israel's frequent deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip and Syria, as well as its atrocities in the occupied territories. Such a stance will simply embolden Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes with impunity. Nonetheless, the ongoing plot against Iran is just exposing the weakness of a regime the U.S. and its Western allies had created in the occupied Palestine. The attack on an Israeli-managed ship and Israel's defeat in its war on Gaza at the hands of resistance groups spotlight the regime's weakness. This also shows the era of hit and run for Israel has come to an end.
North Korea says the South and the United States are risking, quote, a huge security crisis by choosing to escalate tensions. State media cited a top Workers' Party official saying that Seoul and Washington have responded to Pyongyang's goodwill with hostile acts. The statement comes a day after Pyongyang slammed Seoul for going ahead with its annual military exercises with the U.S. even after the North agreed to restore inter-Korean hotlines in late July. On Tuesday, North Korea stopped answering routine calls on the hotlines. The United States has more than 28,000 troops in South Korea. Pyongyang has also always criticized Washington, Seoul joint military drills and viewed them as a threat. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang tells us more about the recent escalation of tensions between North and South Koreas.
Just 2 weeks after the two Koreas restored their severed hotlines, which were severed about a year ago, the South is already conducting nuclear war exercises with the U.S., according to the North, and they have to be able to rapidly respond to that. So they state that even though these nuclear war exercises are tabletop exercises right now, which are only computer simulated drills, that they are demanding that that is not enough, that the U.S. has to pull out all of its troops from ally South Korea and all of its military hardware. So now that leaves the South in a position where they have got to watch what's going on, and they are extremely concerned. The South Koreans, not all of them, but most of them, favor more engagement with North Korea, more willingness to compromise with the North. So I am sure that these moves by the Moon Jae-in administration to try to placate the U.S. by holding these tabletop exercises so soon after the hotlines were restored are not being received very well here in South Korea.
South Korea reports a record number of over 2,200 daily COVID-19 cases, the highest since the pandemic started last January.
With the recent spread of the more transmissible Delta variant virus, the number of confirmed cases is increasing, showing mass infection cases from workplaces, indoor sport facilities, churches, and nursing hospitals. Along with that, the rate of investigating the path of infection is also rising, which means silent spreaders within communities is increasing.
Health Minister Kwon Dok-chol says infections have increased due to the spread of the more transmissible Delta variant and a rise in domestic travel over summer. He urged people who return from holidays to voluntarily get tested before going back to work. South Korean health officials have so far registered more than 216,000 cases with over 2,100 deaths. Some 42% of the country's 52 million population have received at least one dose of vaccine, while the government's target is to increase the number to 70% by September. Australian authorities have extended a lockdown in Melbourne for another 7 days after failing to curb the latest COVID outbreak. 5 million residents of Australia's second-largest city will remain under stay-at-home orders until August 19th. That's mainly due to the emergence of a fresh outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant. Melbourne has been under lockdown for 6 weeks. Sydney is also in its seventh week of lockdown, putting more than 5 million people under stay-at-home orders. Australia's total coronavirus cases have exceeded 37,000, while the death toll stands at over 940. The court in China sentenced a Canadian businessman to 11 years in jail on charges of spying. A statement from a court in Dandong said the businessman illegally provided state secrets to other countries. Michael Spavor was detained in 2018, days after Canada detained telecoms giant Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou on a U.S. extradition request. Spavor's verdict comes a week after fresh hearings in the Meng case began in Vancouver as her lawyers fight to prevent her extradition to the U.S. On Tuesday, another Chinese court rejected an appeal by a Canadian who was sentenced to death for drug smuggling. Ottawa has condemned the verdicts, calling them politically motivated and unjust. The United States has defended its military aid to Egypt despite concerns about the country's human rights record. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's see what our guests have to say about that.
Welcome to another edition of News Review. Thank you for joining us. The United States hails Egypt as a constructive defense partner as Washington considers new military aid to Cairo. At a Senate hearing, State Department and Pentagon officials defended security assistance to Egypt as a critical tool for the Arab country to address its security concerns. U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged no more, quote, blank checks to Cairo due to brutal crackdown on critics. But Washington is considering whether to release $300 million in military aid that Congress has linked to human rights standards. Human rights groups have been urging Biden to exert pressure on Cairo by cutting military aid. The U.S. has been sending $1.3 billion in annual security aid to Egypt. Joining me in this edition of News Review are Abayomi Azikiwe. He is an editor with Pan-African Newswire, joining us out of Detroit, and also Paul Lardy. He is a political analyst, joining us out of Berkeley. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining this edition of the program. If I can start with Abayomi Azikiwe, I want you to shed some light on the importance of Egypt to the United States as a defense partner. How does the U.S. benefit from supporting Cairo with military aid?
If you look at the trajectory of United States foreign policy in Africa and West Asia, you can see clearly that Egypt has played a critical role in undermining the struggle of Palestinian people for national liberation. The U.S. established relations with Egypt in 1922 after it gained independence from the British Protectorate, largely due to the 1919 revolutionary upheaval. And that diplomatic relations was strained in June of 1967 due to the so-called Six-Day War. And actually, under Gamal Abdel Nasser during that period, the diplomatic relations were broken between the United States and Egypt between 1967 and 1974. And under Sadat, they were reestablished. And then by 1978, they had signed the Camp David Accords, and since that time, the United States has supplied at least $50 billion in direct military assistance to Egypt and some $30 billion in direct economic aid. There's also trade agreements between the two countries, foreign direct investment of $24 billion. So Egypt plays a very key role in regard to U.S. foreign policy in the region.
Let's go to our guest in Berkeley. President Biden vowed no more blank checks to Cairo, and he also pledged that he would make human rights a priority in talks with Egypt. Now he's considering new military aid. Isn't it hypocritical, in your opinion?
No, if he doesn't want to send blank checks to Egypt. I think that Egypt will earn every penny that they're being paid, because they will work in the service of the imperialist powers of the United States in order to advance their agenda throughout the Middle East and, frankly, anywhere they want to use it, throughout Africa as well. And this is the role that Egypt plays. It is one of the prize puppets in the puppet collection of the United States.
Thank you so much. Abayomi, I want you to tell us, look, the U.S. has long been supporting countries with poor human rights records like Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. Now, while the Democrats and the Republicans might seem different in their rhetoric, the final outcome of their actions appears to be the same. Do you agree with that?
Yes, because when relations were reestablished in 1974, was a Republican administration. But by 1978, Jimmy Carter, who was a Democrat, was in charge when the Camp David Accords were signed. So successive administrations, whether they're Democrat or Republican, have continued to supply direct military and economic assistance to Egypt. They provided diplomatic cover to Egypt. They've encouraged stronger relations between Egypt and Israel, between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. So this is the problem in regard to rooting out the human rights violations in Egypt and other problems associated with governance there.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the program and sharing your thoughts with us. I've been talking to Abayomi Azikiwe. He is an editor with Pan-African Newswire, joining us out of Detroit. And Paul Lurdy, he is a political analyst, joining us out of Berkeley.
Moving on, forest fires in Algeria have killed 42 people, including 25 soldiers who were deployed to help put out the inferno. The defense ministry said more soldiers have been badly injured with burns. Dozens of fires have been ravaging forests 100 kilometers east of the capital, Algiers, in the Kabyle region, where there are some difficult-to-access villages. Authorities said the simultaneous outbreak of many fires in the same location suggests that arsonists were behind igniting the flames. Last week, a European Union atmosphere monitor said the Mediterranean has become a wildfire hotspot as massive blazes engulfed forests in Turkey and Greece, aided by heat waves. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
History is likely to remember both Rumsfeld and DeSantis as arrogant and reckless public servants who bore significant responsibility for unnecessary and unmitigated disasters, says Roy Adelson, writer, in an article titled Rumsfeld, Then DeSantis, Now, The Lies That Bind. Stay tuned for more. Given the horrific toll of the Iraq War, that disastrous misadventure hardly seems like a good template for combating COVID-19. Yet, in key ways, recent pronouncements from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, whose state is experiencing an overwhelming surge in cases and hospitalizations amid his prohibition on mask requirements, should remind Americans of the propaganda they once heard from Donald Rumsfeld, the late former Secretary of Defense. The deadly consequences are reminiscent too. In particular, three police political mind games stand out. Each takes advantage of a core psychological concern that influences how Americans make sense of the world. First, it's a false alarm. When others raise doubts about your plan, offer overconfident assurances of success. Second, don't blame us. When your rosy predictions are proven wrong, deny that anything could have been done to prevent the setbacks. And third, they are misguided and misinformed. When you are questioned about falling short, attack the media for purportedly misrepresenting events. Tragically, this trio of manipulative appeals has spanned time and space, from Iraq almost 20 years ago to the Sunshine State today. Let's briefly examine each component in turn. The It's a False Alarm mind game targets psychological concerns about vulnerability. It's regularly used by officials to argue that the dangers others have identified are either imaginary or greatly exaggerated. This is a message that fits well with the public's preference to see the world as a predominantly safe place. When Americans are told that their worries are overblown and there is no cause for alarm, they are eager to embrace the good news, especially when the all-clear signal comes from an authoritative source. Unfortunately, such unwarranted guarantees provide opportunities for the continuation of foolhardy and destructive policies. Consider that in 2002, just months before the invasion of Iraq, Rumsfeld confidently assured a radio audience, "I can't tell you if the use of force in Iraq today would last 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months, but it certainly isn't going to last any longer than that." He also boasted, "I don't do quagmires." And 3 weeks into the war, Rumsfeld triumphantly declared, "The Iraqi people are well on their way to freedom." As for concerns raised about lawlessness in Baghdad, he responded, "Stuff happens. Freedom's untidy." So too, the Santis has taken to promoting a deceptive and dangerous upbeat message, one that ignores dire warnings from public health experts. For instance, at a news conference this past February, he explained, "I don't get bent out of shape about these positive tests, because if you test 200,000 people, you're going to get a lot of positive tests, so that's never been the barometer we've used," unquote. More recently, he offered this unfounded assurance about the school year ahead. "I think kids are very low risk. I'm confident that things will go well." The governor is even selling campaign merchandise with mottos like, "How the hell am I going to be able to drink with a mask on?" Turning to the "Don't Blame Us" mind game, this appeal exploits the psychological concerns about issues of helplessness. It's routinely used by officials who want to cover their tracks when anything with their fingerprints on it blows up, literally or figuratively. In these situations, they claim that the responsibility lies elsewhere, or the bad outcomes couldn't possibly have been anticipated, or the resulting harm could never have been prevented anyway. Convincing evidence to support their innocence is rarely provided, but these excuses can still lead the public to underestimate their culpability. For example, as the U.S. death toll in Iraq mounted and the war effort stalled, Rumsfeld refused to admit to any mistakes. During a town hall meeting with troops in late 2004, he dismissed their concerns about inadequate protective equipment this way. You go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time. He then added, you can't have all the armor in the world on a tank, and a tank can be blown up. 6 months later, when questioned about his possible strategic errors, Rumsfeld offered this analysis. You have to remember that in every war, a battle plan doesn't survive first contact with the enemy. This is in history. Why? Because the enemy has a brain and they are constantly adapting. It isn't a mistake, it's reality, unquote. Rejecting any personal responsibility for the ravages of COVID-19 in Florida, DeSantis has once again found his muse in Rumsfeld. Last week, for instance, the governor dismissed the data that imposing restrictions could have reduced or prevented the current spikes in cases. He insisted against the evidence that these interventions have failed time and time again throughout this pandemic. They have not stopped the spread. At the same time, DeSantis downplayed the worrisome trajectory of COVID variants, writing it off as a temporary and inescapable phenomenon. It's a seasonal virus, and this is the seasonal pattern it follows in the Sun Belt states, he added. Finally, the third mind game. They are misguided and misinformed. Preys upon the psychological concerns about who should and shouldn't be trusted. It's frequently used by U.S. officials to undermine the credibility of those who raise serious but unwelcome questions. Asking such questions, of course, is precisely the role that a free press is meant to play. Yet rather than responding directly to these inquiries, those in positions of power often try to cast doubt on the honesty or the expertise of their critics, portraying them as unfairly biased or insufficiently knowledgeable. When this ploy works, it leaves the public confused as to who and what to believe. During the Iraq War, Rumsfeld repeatedly insisted that press coverage was slanted against him and was misleading the American people. Amid early reports of detainee abuse at Guantanamo, he offered this disingenuous response at a news briefing, saying, I haven't found a single scrap of any kind of information that suggests that anyone has been treated anything other than humanely, notwithstanding everything we have read and heard, unquote. A few years later, he issued a much broader condemnatory critique, saying, the worst about America and our military seems to so quickly be taken as truth by the press and reported and spread around the world, often with little context and little scrutiny, let alone correction or accountability after the fact, unquote. As for DeSantis, a year ago he lashed out at the media's COVID coverage this way. We've succeeded, and I think that people just don't want to recognize it because it challenges their narrative. It challenges their assumption. so they have got to try and find a boogeyman. Unquote. Last week, he was still blaming the press, this time for warning people about hospital shortages, saying, "I think it's important to point out because obviously media does hysteria. You try to fearmonger, you try to do this stuff, and when they will talk about hospitalizations, our hospitals are open for business." Unquote. All of these parallels are a stark warning. History is likely to remember both Rumsfeld and DeSantis as arrogant and reckless public servants who bore significant responsibility for unnecessary and unmitigated disasters. Thousands upon thousands of lives have been and will be diminished or destroyed by their manipulative, self-serving mind games. It isn't complicated. The spotlight.
Israel, the U.S., and the group of seven nations are still going on with their blame game against Iran for a drone attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off Oman last week. The UTEP official has also joined the chorus without offering any substantiated evidence. Tel Aviv has even threatened to take military action against Iran. Iran has rejected the allegations as baseless, while at the same time warning Israel against any adventurism. So what's behind this insistence on holding Iran responsible for the attack without offering any evidence?
Iran has once again denied having any link to the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated, saying there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the claim. Ershadi also urged the council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which as usual are blindly supported by certain Western countries. The Iranian diplomat responded to renewed accusations by the U.S. and its allies during Security Council meeting. During the virtual session, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even vowed to punish Iran for the alleged attack. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusations, warning that it will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any threat against its national security. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Saroumi, also warned Israel not to shorten its life by making a wrong and aggressive move. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that Iran is carefully monitoring the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel in the region.
Such moves are made to create chaos and confusion among countries in the Persian Gulf area. Tehran is ready to neutralize any plot to destabilize the region.
Following the ship incident, resistance sources told a media outlet that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrikes on a Syrian airport. But Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel in its blame game against Iran while turning a blind eye to Israel's own hostile acts in the region. According to a report by Wall Street Journal, over a dozen of Iranian vessels had fallen victim to the Israeli attacks, some of which openly claimed by the regime. It seems that the West is trying to shift the international attention from Israel's frequent deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip and Syria, as well as its atrocities in the occupied territories. Such a stance will simply embolden Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes with impunity. Nonetheless, the ongoing plot against Iran is just exposing the weakness of a regime the U.S. and its Western allies had created in the occupied Palestine. The attack on an Israeli-managed ship and Israel's defeat in its war on Gaza at the hands of resistance groups spotlight the regime's weakness. This also shows the era of hit and run for Israel has come to an end.
Okay, that was Matthew Fatima reporting. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Nezif. Allow me to introduce the panelists that are joining me in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have activists and political commentator Leif Meru from Beirut. Also, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magner joining us from Brussels. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me start with Beirut. Light, what's behind this persistent blame game launched against Iran? I mean, how can one hold another responsible for an act in the absence of any solid evidence?
Well, because the United States as an empire and apartheid Israel as a supremacist entity, both of them believe that they don't have to apply to international law and that they can live with this creation of rule of theirs that they call Western-based order or rule-based order. So it is, they have the right to attack the shipping lanes and containers and ships of others. They have that the right to attack sovereign territories of Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and nobody else has the right to retaliate. This is as simple as it is. The United States and with it apartheid Israel have decided that the international law doesn't apply to them, and they want to apply their rule over others. And this is where the crux of the issue of resistance in Western Asia, in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen, is all about sovereignty and self-determination and continuing the struggle of decolonization that hasn't yet come to full fruition since the end of World War I and World War II.
Now turn to Brussels. Elijah, in 1967, Israel, during the war with Egypt, attacked a clearly marked U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty. It killed 34 crew members. The aim was to drag the U.S. into war with Egypt. Now, is Tel Aviv doing the same thing here again, trying to drag Washington into a war with Tehran?
Well, I don't think it's the same scenario today, because neither Israel nor the U.S., all the U.S. allies, are willing to confront Iran in an open war. What they're trying to do is to try to convince as many countries as possible to condemn Iran at the United Nations. Unfortunately, the world is not seeing and is not concentrating on the repetitive attacks that the Israelis have carried on against civilian ships and oil tankers in the open sea. It is something that the Israelis have recognized, acknowledged, and after that, the Americans and the Israelis are just trying to put pressure on Iran to bring it back to the nuclear table for the negotiation on a nuclear agreement that Iran is not willing to do unless the U.S. comply with its commitment signed in 2015. I don't think the aim is to carry on an attack or to try to confront or wage attack on Iran. I think is to mount the pressure and to increase different kind of pressure on Iran to force it to another agenda, particularly when Sayed Ibrahim Raisi is now in power and is not showing and sending many indications that he's not going to be flexible on the matter of Iranian national security.
Okay, Laith, Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that it's closely watching all suspicious moves by the U.S., U.K., and Israel in this region and is ready to neutralize any destabilizing plot. So my question is almost in the same in the line I ask Elijah. Why is this happening at this juncture of time?
Well, look, there is two realities at play here. One of them is the fact that there is no return to the nuclear deal because the United States and apartheid Israel want to add the discussion of Iran's ballistic missiles and the alliance for the resistance assets in Western Asia. And those are things that Iran is not willing to negotiate, and the new president was elected through the voters wanting an end to the Rouhani scam that happened of just wasting all these years on this agreement. And given the fact that the United States even didn't deliver on that original Iran nuclear deal because it claimed that it didn't pass it in the Congress or Senate, it's clear that nothing that the United States signs, even if it signs it through a Security Council resolution, is to be trusted, because there's no way any deal, no matter how much Iran gives to the United States and apartheid Israel, will be passed through the Congress and the Senate. The political bodies in the United States want to destroy Iran and the resistance in the region. Fortunate to Iran and to the resistance, that's the reality they cannot achieve. And that's where the conflict comes in the behavior of the United States. It is hitting left and right like a cat that is cornered. Thus, the empire knows its end is coming and is acting up in really destructive ways to its own self.
Okay, Elijah, Israel has attacked multiple Iranian ships in the past couple of years in broad daylight and got away with it. I mean, why didn't European and American leaders hold Israel responsible for those violations?
First of all, we cannot count on Europe, because Europe is just aligned itself behind the U.S. for whatever U.S. wants. Secondly, the international community has double standards, and the problem is the word listen to them, and I don't think Iran should listen to them, because everything they've been saying, it doesn't make any sense, is against international law. They are in clear violation of international laws, and they can't see what the Israelis are doing, including not only the attacks on oil tankers and other vessels, but the assassination of nuclear scientists and other destructive and sabotage attack in Iran. And that is a clear violation of international laws. Therefore, the only conclusion we can come out with is something that has been going on for many years now, is the international law doesn't matter. It is only applied when the U.S. and its allies want it to apply on a particular country that is refusing the U.S. hegemony and is seeking the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from West Asia. So the double standard is nothing new. The world is no longer a fool, but we see that European diplomat and politician have no courage to stand against the Americans and can no longer even honor their commitment. And we saw that in 2018 when President Donald Trump shredded the nuclear deal and Europe was not able to stand by its commitment. Therefore, it's not surprising to see the U.S. and Europe standing behind Israel for whatever Israel is doing. If we look also not only the attacks against Iran, but the violation against Lebanon, the thousand attacks against Syria, and the continuous killing in Gaza of the Palestinians, all these crime, international crime, and a violation of international laws is something that Israel has been carrying on since many decades under the watchful eyes and impotent eyes of the international community.
Now, Leith, do you share the same view as Elijah in that matter?
Well, clearly, the experience that the world has since the end of World War II is that all these European countries are just vessels. They are occupied directly by American forces. And the struggle has been since that day to bring sovereignty to decolonizing nations in Asia and Africa and Latin America. And that has been the crux of the human struggle. And the only way that any nation receives those sovereign rights of self-determination is through fighting it and defeating the colonizer. The Americans just, apartheid Israel acts as a beachhead war colony that extends the imperial order in the region. And they will fight to keep maintain that. One thing that is important to note is that just a few hours, some of the Iranian officials said that they are tracking an Israeli submarine escorted by two warships that are crossing towards the Red Sea, probably on their way to the Gulf. So no matter how much any logical being would understand that in a conflict that between Iran or with it, the resistance axis versus the United States and Israel, there'll be hundreds of thousands of losses of American soldiers and Israeli soldiers within minutes because of the direct missile that will hit all the American bases in West Asia. That's the logic for anybody with a little bit of brain to understand that. So watching how the United States and apartheid Israel are acting, it shows you absolute desperation. They really are probably just trying to bluff. I hope for that, because no war is good for anybody.
Okay. Now, Elijah, in response to that unfounded allegation against Tehran attacking that Israeli managed ship off Oman, Tehran has made it clear that breach of security in the Persian Gulf waters is a red line. And Israel says it's ready to attack Iran. They publicized it recently that we are ready to attack Iran. Iran says we are ready if you dare do so. How likely is Tel Aviv to take military action against Iran?
I think it's extremely unlikely. I do not exclude the intelligence attacks, which means the sabotage and attack on ships or attack in different theater, because today all theaters, starting from Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran, are all joined, and Israel can attack in any of these theaters. And I think Iran can do the same because it has strong allies and it has a strong presence. I don't think Israel dares to attack overtly Iran. Iran has the capability to defend itself. It shows the type of missiles Iran has managed to construct and the type of capability and advanced technology that it has reached, and it can reach Israel if Israel dares to attack Iran. I totally exclude a direct attack. I think the kind of tit for tat can continue, and I don't think Iran should just turn the other cheek to the Israelis when the Israelis try to do something, because as President Ibrahim Raisi told President Macron during the conversation yesterday, that Iran is determined to impose the strategy of deterrence. And by responding to any Israeli or American attack against Iran, this is how Iran is committed to impose strategic deterrence and prevent any attack against its territory or against its interests.
Okay, Leif, how do you look at this? What's the possibility of Israel attacking Iran militarily?
If they are logical, they will not be attacking. If they have any sense in their mind that they will not be attacking, because it's clear the damage and weapons that are on each side, what will happen. We've seen already an example of just a small group like Hamas and Islamic Jihad facing off with apartheid Israel 2 months ago. The damage that that group caused to the supposed mighty Israeli forces. We saw a few days ago Hezbollah responding immediately to an attack by apartheid Israel on Lebanese territory. So it's very clear that the damage that will come from Iran, a nation of 90-plus million people, industrialized with advanced weapons, specifically missiles and drones, will exact a heavy price on the Israelis. So my only worry is that the Zionists and the imperialists have lost their mind. We've seen their society deteriorate. We've seen the outcomes of the elections of Trump and now Biden. It's an empire in decay, where it's like a chicken with its head cut off and it's flailing. So we don't know what crazy decisions they may take, and that's what everybody needs to be watching out for.
Okay. Now, Elijah, the Group of Seven says that Iran's behavior threatens international peace and security. It's Iran that proposed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, and talks with Persian Gulf littoral states to address any concerns if they have. And it's Iran that, as you know, helped Iraq get rid of Daesh terrorists and many more such instances. So who's a threat to regional security?
The only threat to the regional security, I see, is the presence of the U.S. forces in the Middle East and West Asia. We saw how Iran managed to agree on 3 meetings with Saudi Arabia and Iraq. We saw how the possibility between countries of the Middle East can unite and can talk about their problems and try to sort out their problems without the U.S. intervention. And I think the U.S. is occupying Afghanistan, and after 20 years, it is forced to pull out, is occupying Iraq, and now it is forced to start thinking about pulling out its forces. It is still occupying Syria. That is creating a real havoc in the Middle East. Why on earth the Americans are still in Syria? As Donald Trump said rightly, he's stealing the oil. That is destabilizing Syria as a sovereign country and stealing its wealth and preventing the economy and the country from recovering. This is destabilizing the country. What the U.S. is doing in Lebanon is exactly the same. What the U.S. is doing in Iraq is preventing Iraq from having contract with Siemens, a German company, to mount the attack on the government from the population, and so people are unhappy. So all that is created by the Americans. The Iranians have supported Syria according to the request of the Syrian government. He is willing to support Lebanon with oil and gas if the government is willing to take it. It is supporting Iraq with electricity. It is supporting Yemen, the small and poorest country in the Middle East, facing a huge war machine from the Saudis, supported by the U.S. and its allies against the poor Yemeni people. That is destabilizing the region. And what they are doing is they continue their war. They haven't stopped. They continue bombing in Afghanistan. They continue occupying Syria. They continue presence in Iraq despite the decision of the Iraqi government asking them to pull out. And they continue destabilizing Lebanon by impoverishing the country and putting pressure on the economy and preventing the government from dealing with Russia or China or looking west and east. So right. All these are destabilizing factors that the Americans are responsible of in West Asia.
Okay. Light, G7 minister is also calling for the vessels in this region to be able to navigate freely and in accordance with international law. That's exactly what Iran has been for. Iran has even gone the extra mile, taken out to, you know, further waters, off its borders, and protecting other vessels from different nationalities against pirate attacks. Let's have your comments in 1 minute, please.
Well, it's very clear that the United States and apartheid Israel are highway bandits, are pirates. We've seen how they had attacked Iranian vessels, bringing oil and products to Venezuela. We've seen Britain attempt to do that too, because it felt that it can bring its paydays back. We've seen apartheid Israel do that to attack ships coming to Syria and to Lebanon. We've seen what the Saudis have been doing, attacking ships coming to Yemen. And so we know clearly who are the pirates, who are the highway bandits, who are the lawless states, and that is the United States and apartheid Israel. And the struggle right now that Iran is at the crux of with this resistance axis will hopefully change the face of Western Asia to the better.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Thank you, my guest, activist and political commentator Leith Meharouf from Beirut, and journalist and public analyst Elijah Magnier from Brussels. Stopping your host, Behrouz Ezra. Thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hosseiniya. To His Path, from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa bihi nasta'in.
Dr. Fakhr Rouhani.
In this episode, we are going to be concerned with a short conversation that took place between Imam al-Hussein al-Salam and his stepbrother Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya. We know that when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam found out that all pressures were going to be exerted on him in order to make him recognize Yazid ibn Muawiyah as the new Umayyad ruler, and that Yazid ibn Muawiyah had no right to claim rulership, the third infallible Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam decided to leave Medina because it was no longer safe for him. Some people, that is, some of the close associates and relatives of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, recommended him not to leave Medina because they all feared about the life and safety of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. One of such people was Imam al-Hussein's stepbrother, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah. In answer to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah's suggestion not to leave Medina, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicated in this way: "O brother, may Allah reward you abundantly. You have indeed expressed your advice and pointed to the right choice. But I am determined to set out to Mecca. For this purpose, my followers, nephews, brothers, and I have got ready. The decision is mine. The decision is mine and the opinion is mine. However, you are not like them in this regard. You are supposed to stay in Medina so as to remain my eye and my reporter over them, the Umayyad agents. You shouldn't hide any one of the activities from me." It indicates that, I mean, these words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicate that Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah was a true well-wisher for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Yet, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was determined to have at least one confident person in Medina in order to report to him the latest updates about the situation in Medina. Now we find that in another dialect, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicated it in this way to his stepbrother Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah: "O brother, if there wouldn't be any shelter or place of refuge in the world, I would never take the oath of allegiance with Yazid ibn Muawiyah." So we find that, according to a precise words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he was determined, he was resolute not to recognize Yazid ibn Muawiyah, because Yazid ibn Muawiyah wasn't the right person to assume that important and critical post of rulership of Muslims. In addition, we find that the current of usurping the rights of the Ahlul Bayt started right after the demise of the Prophet Muhammad at Saqifah. So we find that a divergent line started, and the coming of Muawiyah, and especially the coming of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, could be regarded as a sinister continuation of that divergent line. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was the most appropriate personality for assuming rulership. Hence, it was expected of him not to recognize Yazid ibn Muawiyah, and indeed, he acted in this way.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as